From Oklahoma to Maryland, South Dakota to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Joe Biden has issued an executive order to increase competition in the American economy, but there will be negative effects. Alden Abbott from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. It is budget time in Washington, D.C., and Senate Democrats are pushing for trillions in new spending. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. How many people does it take to drive a train? More than you think when labor unions get involved. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the COVID-19 vaccine is good for most people, but requiring folks to get it is a violation of individual rights. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It is supposed to increase competition and benefit consumers, but President Joe Biden's sweeping executive order on economic competitiveness will have significant negative effects, including unleashing a new wave of federal regulations. To parse through the proposal, we are joined by Alden Abbott. He is a former general counsel at the Federal Trade Commission and now a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Alden, welcome to American Radio Journal. Alden, before we get into a discussion, the president's executive order promoting competition in the American economy, give us a brief outline as to what's included in that order.
Basically, the order directs independent and executive branch agencies to work with the White House, a new competition council, to deal with what are described as a variety of anti-competitive practices in a large number of industries, including healthcare, telecommunications, surface transportation, air transportation, farming, and labor markets. And the general theme seems to be that agencies need to be much more aggressive in using their statutory and regulatory powers to deal with problems of lax competition, of excessive mergers, of, generally speaking, of harm to consumers because of what's described as weak competition.
You have said that the underlying problem with this order is that it is based on the false premise that competition has diminished significantly in recent decades and that big is bad. Has, in fact, competition diminished, and is big always bad?
Big is not necessarily bad. Sometimes if you have a great innovator, for instance, that gets into local markets like Walmart, reduces prices for consumers. Temporarily or for a while, that may make it seem as if there's higher concentration because in a local market there's one big retailer and the smaller firms suddenly have smaller percentage shares. But does that mean consumers are worse off? Not at all. They have their old stores often, and now they have a lower-priced alternative. And there were studies in the 1970s by a number of University of Chicago economists that debunked the idea big was bad. They say that, in fact, you have high returns to investment. Often it signifies firms have become more competitive. They've come out with new innovations, lowered costs. So instead of seeing higher prices for consumers, no, you're seeing high returns, profits for companies because they've lowered costs. And indeed, in all sorts of areas where government hasn't been heavily involved, like provision of cell phones, electronic equipment, things of that sort, prices have fallen dramatically in the last decade or so, and quality has risen. Certainly not a sign of reduced competition. Where prices have not reacted perhaps as favorably often is in areas where government regulation is still very much present and overbearing. For example, healthcare. Healthcare competition perhaps could be stronger, but a lot of that has to do with complex government regulations that have created all sorts of disincentives for efficient provision of services.
In addition to all of that, there are some positive effects to this. So if you could talk for just a minute about what you see as the positive effects of the president's executive order.
There are certain things that, in fact, I think the last administration recognized it all as well. For example, the high price of hearing aids, big issue for older people. There are regulations that have prevented hearing aids from being sold directly by pharmacies, directly by stores. Lifting those will increase competition, allow lower cost hearing aid prices. That was just artificial regulation that prevented true competition in the sale of hearing aids. There's an encouragement for reducing barriers to occupational licensing. State rules, for example, typically state rules, you might require a cosmetologist to get in 1,000 hours of training to have a basic cosmetology job or barber's job. And that's just protects incumbents, makes it very hard for people to get on the first rung of the economic ladder, and it's really unfair and not economically efficient and harmful. These are artificial restrictions. The only problem, and that's good, the only problem is that lots of those are run by the states. I mean, to the extent the federal government, which has actually been the case for the last 5 years, continues to encourage the states to lower those restrictions, that's good. There also could be specialized federal legislation in areas where the government has direct responsibility, like the armed forces, to allow spouses of members of the armed forces to have practice their trade wherever they are, and that could break down some of these restrictions. So that's good. Again, I think those ideas are not bad ideas. They have to be handled well, but they're not new. It's not as if these ideas were not around and being considered prior to the arrival of the Biden administration.
And very quickly, a couple of the negative impacts of the president's proposals.
Well, I think the negative impacts is that he'd require a lot of mergers to be second-guessed, to be looked at again, to be challenged. There's been an understanding, general understanding, that if a merger is not challenged under our antitrust laws, if years later, except in extraordinary cases, it won't be, because that will create a lot of disincentives to efficient reorganizations of industries. That is a real threat now. Also, while certain actions need to be taken in the healthcare area, the hint that there might be a national government option as opposed to provision of private health insurance, and also the suggestion that the government might try to get involved in price controls on drugs, not just generics, but a whole variety of drugs, could very much undermine investment in new pharmaceuticals and slow down improvements in healthcare due to new drugs. Also, the idea in general that there have to be new regulations on all sorts of occupational areas to help consumers, often new regulations have very unintended consequences and tend to slow down innovation and prevent companies from adapting to changes in the market. So I think the whole heavily regulatory tone of a lot of the order affecting a lot of different industries would tend to slow down innovation and economic growth.
We have been talking with Alden Abbott, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that located, of course, at George Mason University. Alden, tell us just a bit about Mercatus. Also, what is your web address?
Mercatus is a nonprofit research organization that undertakes research. We have quite a few scholars and has an affiliation with George Mason University. Mercatus's web address is www.mercatus.org, MERCATUS.ORG. Mercatus means market, as in free market.
Alden Abbott of the Mercatus Center. Alden, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Loman. I really appreciate your time.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, where matters financial are going to be taking up a lot of time in Congress over the coming weeks and months. He's going to explain the process to us. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman. It's great to be here.
The federal budgeting process, this whole idea of appropriations, reconciliations, deadlines, continuing resolutions, all these phrases get thrown about here, Scott. It can be very confusing for the average citizen. So in a nutshell, what can we look forward to as we head into the month of August and into the fall and for the balance of the year relative to the budget process in Congress?
Congress needs to pass a concurrent budget resolution, meaning they need to pass a budget through the Senate and through the House before they can have access to this special tool to accommodate bipartisan legislation that we call reconciliation. Reconciliation is supposed to be budgetary in nature, so you're not supposed to have major policy changes like a minimum wage increase or immigration reform or climate change on reconciliation legislation, but you are allowed to do things like tax cuts, and Obamacare was done through reconciliation. They've done financial reform through reconciliation. So there's a number of policy items that the Senate precedent allows to go through what they call the Byrd Rule. And the first step is obviously that the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats need to pass a budget resolution to basically include instructions to the various committees in Congress that will be tasked with doing the major lifting for the reconciliation legislation. Typically, that's the Senate Finance Committee, the HELP Committee. It can also include Energy and Public Works, EPW. It's really up to the committee chairman and the leadership on how expansive they want to make the reconciliation instructions, and that indicates what the size and scope of the bill can be. So this week, what we saw was Senate Democrats, led by Bernie Sanders, coming out of the Budget Committee with a huge agreement for $3.5 trillion in new spending over the next decade related to so-called infrastructure projects. And for some of these Democrats, they've said, well, this proposal needs to be fully paid for. And Joe Manchin is once again in a power position in terms of trying to determine what the offsets will be. Well, the Senate Democrats have said that the three offsets are going to be tax reform, which means tax increases. In particular, they want to increase the corporate income tax rate, and they also want to increase the capital gains tax rate. And they want to increase taxes on millionaires and billionaires and have a wealth tax. And they want to explore all these ideas to basically confiscate wealth and decrease prosperity in America. Additionally, they say that there's going to be healthcare reforms that will save a lot of money, meaning they're going to reform our entitlement programs. That's basically a budget gimmick. And then they say the final offset would be economic growth, because, of course, stimulating the economy with $3.5 trillion is just going to provide for massive GDP growth in the Democrats' view. I think that's a false premise, and the bottom line is we are incurring a level of inflation that we really haven't seen in nearly a generation due to the Democrats' spending recently related to the coronavirus stimulus. So Joe Biden's out there. He's now going to champion this bill with Bernie Sanders. In the meantime, you still do have that other bipartisan negotiation that some of these Senate Republicans have basically been fooled to come to the negotiating table thinking that Democrats will actually work with them to do anything of consequence. And Nancy Pelosi's holding that bipartisan agreement hostage. She says she wants to see the reconciliation bill come over to the House before she does anything in a bipartisan fashion. So what we're going to be watching in the coming months is, first of all, this budget resolution needs to come forward that includes the reconciliation instructions. And they're trying to do that prior to the August recess. So that could be an urgent item that gets adjudicated within the next 3 weeks. And then we'll have probably a short August recess. If they don't finish their work, they'll stay in August, and then they'll finish it, and then, of course, they'll go home for a few weeks. Basically, think about it this way. A budget authorizes how much money you've got on the credit card to spend, and then the appropriations is actually going out and spending the money.
It sounds to me, Scott, like what a lot of you just outlined is more policy than fiscal. So can actually all of that be included and pass muster in a reconciliation bill?
Well, this is how the sausage gets made in Washington, right? It's sort of a cliche, but there are very complicated arguments that get made to the Senate parliamentarian. She is like the referee of the United States Senate. Now, just because she says that her belief in the Senate precedent rules is that X, Y, and Z is permitted or A, B, and C is not allowed, the Senate can still appeal the ruling of the chair and change precedent in the Senate to pass the legislation. There's been arguments from both sides on whether or not if you put in a carbon tax to accommodate climate change, is that more about climate change? Is it more about the fiscal policy related to the taxation on carbon emissions? There's strong arguments. There's really smart people on both sides of the aisle that are going to be debating this in closed doors, obviously not on CNN or MSNBC or Fox News.
So a lot of arcane maneuvering that has very big real-life impacts. We are going to monitor all this as we go through the process over the coming months. We're going to do so with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
So the Club for Growth is a membership organization. We have over 500,000 members united in this idea of economic freedom and economic liberty. We are a 501c4 that does issue advocacy. That's basically what we've been discussing today on the show. And if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually sign up and become a member at Club for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Labor unions want the federal government to step in and mandate railroads to hire more people than necessary to operate a train. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
President Joe Biden's planned $2.2 trillion infrastructure package is more than just a huge barrel of federal cash for road, bridge, and rail projects. It also provides a once-every-decade or so opportunity for Congress to reauthorize and rewrite the surface transportation laws, the laws that govern trucks and trains and just about everything that moves around in this country. And that, in turn, provides an opportunity for special interests to get their hooks into the rules and mandates that go into federal policy when not many people are actually looking. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Today, we are taking a look into one of those niche fights over the surface transportation laws regarding a mandate involving how many people have to be riding in the cab of a freight train. This is one of those things that maybe isn't exactly everybody's cup of tea. I realize that, but I'm sort of darkly fascinated by these niche fights that happen over like these little policies that nobody really pays attention to. It's impossible even for members of Congress to read every detail of these multi-hundred page long bills that they pass. And it's certainly beyond the pale for anybody in the general public, people who have real jobs out there, to pay much attention to these things. And most of those little fights that happen over small federal policies are pretty unremarkable. But the one that's shaping up between the railroad industry and its labor unions presents kind of an interesting conundrum for the Biden administration, and that's why it interests me. And it could actually have significant ramifications for the broader economy and even for efforts to reduce carbon emissions and curb global warming. So the big question here, or the basic question here, is how many people does it take to drive a train? And labor unions like the Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers of America have been lobbying for a while to get federal regulators to mandate that all freight trains operate with two-person crews in the cab. And that's long been the standard industry practice anyway for what should be fairly obvious safety reasons. And those two people have different duties and responsibilities and different job titles, actually. The engineer is the person who actually drives the train, who accelerates or decelerates, applies the brakes, actually gets the train going. And then the other person in the cab is known as the rail conductor, and they're responsible for handling equipment inspections and monitoring track signals. The two of them work together to make sure that a train can get safely from point A to point B. Now, unions are worried about the fact that advanced automation is increasing, and it will eventually allow railroads to run safely without that second person in the engine. And they want the government to step in to protect those jobs, to mandate that railroads continue to have two people in the cab of all freight trains. Now, that dreaded automation that the unions are worried about is indeed occurring. In fact, all major rail systems in the U.S. now use something called positive train control, which is essentially a computer-based override system that monitors speed and track signals to avoid collisions. And the adoption of positive train control was actually mandated by Congress back in 2008, and it has helped to dramatically reduce the number of rail accidents in the country. According to the Association of American Railroads, Accidents are down 30% since 2000, while employee injuries on the job have fallen by about 40%. Railroading overall is safer now than it has ever been, and it is safer in large part due to these technological advances. With positive train control systems handling many of the in-cab duties that were formerly the responsibility of the rail conductor, railroads are now seeking to reassign some of those workers. And because rail conductors typically do equipment inspections and perform other duties before trains depart from rail yards and after they return, it means that most rail conductors will continue to work in that capacity, but they may not be required to go out, you know, riding the rails with the engineer every day because the computers can handle those duties. But any changes to the employment structure have to be approved as part of collective bargaining between the railroads and their unions. And so the union's lobbying effort can really best be understood as a way to gain the upper hand in those negotiations. Because after all, if the federal government mandates that there have to be two people in the cab of the train, then the railroads won't be able to negotiate for any other arrangements. During the waning days of the Obama administration, the unions nearly got what they wanted. In 2016, the Federal Railroad Administration proposed a rule that would have mandated two-person rail crews. But after investigating the issue for several years, the FRA concluded in 2019 that that mandate was not necessary or appropriate for railroad operations to be conducted safely. Case closed, right? Well, sure, unless Congress gets involved, which is exactly what could happen this year as part of the big Biden infrastructure plan. The president, as you've probably heard, is a big fan of trains, and the White House has set some ambitious goals for reducing America's carbon emissions during the next few decades. Trains could actually be a major part of that, because moving 1 ton of cargo 1 mile by truck emits several times as much carbon dioxide as moving the same cargo by rail. But mandating that the railroad industry employ twice as many people to drive each train means higher costs, and those higher costs will end up being passed on to consumers. A 2015 study found that switching from two-person to one-person rail crews could save railroad companies as much as $2.5 billion over the next decade. And those savings would reduce the cost of rail freight, making train transportation more economical. That in turn could mean fewer trucks on America's highway and less exhaust being spewed into the atmosphere. But despite those potential environmental benefits, siding with the railroads could alienate Biden's labor union allies. So the president is stuck in a little bit of a bind here. Still, without clear and convincing evidence that two-person crews are necessary for trains to operate safely, and with positive train control already doing a better job of preventing accidents than humans used to do, there's no compelling reason for the government to get involved in this dispute. Private railroads and the private unions can make their own arrangements and work it out through the collective bargaining process. No mandates are needed. And if Biden needs more convincing about that fact, he should just check in with his beloved Amtrak. Because the government-run passenger rail system dropped its own two-people-in-the-cab mandate all the way back in the 1980s. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the transportation package and of everything else that's going on in Congress and Washington, D.C. these days at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Although he is pro-vaccine, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says making it mandatory is a violation of individual freedom. He explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
A bill banning employers from mandating that their workers be forced to receive COVID vaccines continues to move through the Pennsylvania legislature. And Pennsylvania, which is my home state, is not alone. Other legislatures nationwide are doing the same. The sponsor of the Pennsylvania bill, Representative Russ Diamond, called it a, quote, very simple question of workers' rights, unquote. It is indeed. It's also a very simple question of human rights and a very simple question of constitutional rights. Bills like this should be supported and applauded. Now, before I go further, let me state why I believe I have some credibility on this subject. I published a bunch of articles last year in this and did several American Radio Journal commentaries expressing my great concern over COVID and about the crucial need for a vaccine. I was anything but a COVID skeptic. To the contrary, I was called a COVID alarmist. I've never opposed vaccines. And I wrote and I spoke very positively last spring about promising efforts at my alma mater, the University of Pittsburgh, to develop COVID vaccines. I was also a staunch advocate for President Trump's Operation Warp Speed.
Moreover, I worked in immunology at the University of Pittsburgh from 1987 to 91 as an employee for Dr. Thomas Starzl's organ transplant team. He was the guy who pioneered organ transplantation. I collected data and did research on the crucial immunosuppressants and other drugs related to trying to get the body to accept a transplanted organ. Those included the so-called miracle drug that revolutionized organ transplantation, FK-506. So, in sum, I've never been an anti-vaxxer. Now, having said all that, no one should be able to force me or any American to inject something into our bodies against our will, our conscience, and our constitutional liberties, especially when other Americans can easily and freely choose to get vaccinated and receive protection. Moreover, many of those choosing not to get vaccinated are doing so because they already had COVID, and they don't want to take a vaccine that even the FDA and pharmaceutical companies explicitly warn are experimental, and amid many alarming reports of people claiming some bad side effects. Yes, experimental. The official fact sheet for recipients and caregivers of the Pfizer vaccine states categorically, now listen carefully, quote, "The Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine is a vaccine and may prevent you from getting COVID-19. There is no U.S. Food and Drug Administration-approved vaccine to prevent COVID-19. Read that again. There is no FDA-approved vaccine to prevent COVID-19. Now, for probably most Americans who haven't had COVID, especially those who are vulnerable with comorbidities, old age, or obesity, they're willing to take that risk, and I support them totally. That's a free will choice that doesn't violate their conscience or constitutional protections. The freedom not to be forced into receiving experimental vaccines is especially critical for those of us who had COVID, such as myself, and now have antibodies, particularly given the latest research. To that end, a new peer-reviewed study published in the journal Nature found that patients who have recovered from COVID develop, quote, long-lasting immunity, unquote. The study notes that this stands contrary to media assertions made in 2020, which were based on insufficient information. To quote Ali Alabedi, professor of pathology at Washington University School of Medicine and a senior author of the study, quote, "Last fall, there were reports that antibodies wane quickly after infection with a virus that causes COVID-19, and mainstream media interpreted that to mean that immunity was not long-lived. But that was a misinterpretation of the data. We found antibody-producing cells in people 11 months after the first symptoms. These cells will live and produce antibodies for the rest of people's lives." Now, here's another important study. A major research effort by the Cleveland Clinic conducted on over 52,000 employees, flatly concluded that individuals who had COVID, quote, "do not get additional benefits from vaccination," unquote. The Cleveland Clinic study is based on a massive and statistically significant sample size. It's the most thorough study to date. So in light of this latest research and the other factors I've mentioned, no one, and certainly not private employers, should be forcing people, their employees, to take what are still technically experimental vaccines against their will. This is America, and you can't do that to people. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thank you for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WNCD-FM, WAKZ-FM, and WMXY-FM, all in Youngstown, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.